Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Policy changes in Washington could have implications for Hawaii in health care and Medicaid expansion under the ACA, and changes in Hawaii could bring a not-so-welcome reaction from Washington if, for example, an adequate financial solution to the rail deficit can't soon be found. U.S. Senator Mazie Hirono has long supported the rail project. She's en route home to Hawaii to hold two town meetings, one on Oahu and one on Kauai. We spoke yesterday while she was still in D.C., and I asked her how she's viewing the end of the legislative session, its standoff, and shakeup over rail.
Clearly, there are dynamics at the legislative level that they need to resolve. And what I've focused on regarding rail is to make sure that the federal funding is there for the federal share. And about an hour ago, I voted for the omnibus spending bill that completed the federal funding for the project. So that's the part that I focused on. And I think that the legislature and the city council and HART and the board and all those folks need to continue to try to work things out.
What happens, though, if in the event they really can't?
My view is that they will. You know, the governor's leadership and the mayor's leadership will need to very much step up, I would say.
Well, that's been said over and over again here, too. But the question of, and a lot of people are wondering, is how they can possibly see this project through if the federal government isn't convinced that Hawaii can actually pull through and complete the project. Is there anything that you see that hasn't happened that should have?
I think it's really hard for me to opine on the dynamics of the last few weeks and, in fact, coming up to today. So, as I said, I was focusing very much on making sure that the federal share is there. And, yes, the FTA will continue their dialogue, particularly with the county, as to their plan. And then my hope is that we will be able to go forward in some fashion because I do support rail.
At this point, when we're looking at so many different issues, a big one is health care.
Oh, yes.
As the House has just voted to be able to advance the repeal and replace, clearly that's going to be a very different situation when it gets to the Senate. What happens with you?
Well, first of all, what the latest iteration of the House is taking a bad bill, which couldn't even make it out of the House the first time, and if possible, they made it even worse. In terms of the people who will be covered, in terms of the costs. I think there's some argument that this is going to lower insurance costs, but you can lower costs if you begin to restrict coverage. So, hey, my premiums would be really low if my health care only covered tonsillectomies, for example. So that's the kind of shibai that's going on in terms of people arguing for this bill. But the bottom line is that millions of people will be off the health care. And this will impact about 20,000 people who purchase insurance on our exchange. And then it'll also have a very negative impact on Medicaid coverage for about 100,000 people on Quest.
When this gets to the Senate, the situation may be very different than what we've just seen in the House.
It will be very different. One of the reasons is I believe that there are a number of Republican senators who are not prepared to vote for this. But in addition, we have different requirements for voting. And no matter what, how it proceeds, I think that there will be enough concerns raised that there's very little chance that this very bad Trump care bill out of the House will emerge intact out of the Senate, if it even emerges, because we do have a few other things that the Senate is wanting to address. And frankly, Beth Ann, I think it would be more worthwhile for us to move on things such as support for infrastructure, because we're way behind on infrastructure resources. That creates jobs. It would be long-term improvements to our infrastructure. And that's something that I think we can actually work in a bipartisan way, which includes the president.
With Hawaii, we understand that we've already put in a waiver that regardless of whatever happens, that we will be able to have the same standard of care that we've had with prepaid health care.
I think that Hawaii is way ahead of the rest of the country in that we've had prepaid health care in Hawaii for over 35 years or so. And I think that level of coverage, that we did not have an issue for those covered under prepaid health care with things like pre-existing conditions, et cetera. But we want to make sure that our prepaid health care stays intact. The state is pursuing various waivers to make sure that that happens.
As we only have you for a short time, I'm going to skip on, and I want to talk to you a little bit about North Korea. Clearly, people here are concerned about that. People across the United States are concerned about that. How concerned are you?
Of course we're concerned, but we had Admiral Harris, who is the Pacific Command, testify before the Senate Armed Services Committee last week. And one of the questions I asked him, of course, is Hawaii safe from attacks from North Korea? And he said, we have adequate protections right now. In fact, the places that are much more vulnerable, of course, to any reaction on the part of North Korea would be South Korea and Japan, and that would, of course, draw in the United States. It's very clear that we need to pursue strongly a diplomatic resolution of this situation, because any kind of military conflict regression will result in a lot of deaths and a tremendous, it would be terrible. So diplomatic resolution must be pursued, and that includes China's involvement and support.
Admiral Harris also indicated that he would be in favor of having missile interceptors based in Hawaii. How about you?
Well, basically, you're talking about Aegis Ashore being operationalized on Kauai. We talked about radar capability, increasing that capability, and he says that that is a good way to go, and he doesn't want to go get ahead of some of the discussions and decision-making. But there is no question that we are all concerned about making sure that Hawaii is protected. The first line of defense in something like this, where miscalculation could lead to horrendous results, would be to pursue the diplomatic resolution.
And lastly, before we have to let you go, you recently introduced the Coral Reef Sustainability Through Innovation Act.
Yes.
How much attention do you think that's going to be able to get, given the climate that we see now in Congress?
We don't have an administration that is very much focused on science, and that's why I'm glad that scientists marched last week. Who heard of scientists marching, but that's a good thing. There's not a lot of focus on environmental protections and concerns by this administration, I admit. That just makes it even more important that there are those of us who will raise these concerns, and we will introduce bills and continue to push for the kind of responses, in this case, coral reef protection, because we know that our coral reefs are very critical to our habitat, our environment, tourism, all of that. It represents hundreds of millions of dollars to the state of Hawaii. And we want to promote innovative thinking about how we can decrease the damage to our coral reefs. So this is a bill that I introduced last Congress also that would provide incentives for big thinkers to come up with reef protection solutions. Real solutions. So we will just keep on focusing our energies and making sure that people understand that this is happening, climate change deniers notwithstanding. I think it's just one of many battles that we have to fight. But I am having a town hall meeting this Saturday in both Oahu and Kauai. And so particularly for your listeners on Oahu, it's going to be at 10 a.m. on Saturday at Kaimiki High School. And for your listeners on Kauai, 3 p.m., Chief Eskamakaheli Middle School on Saturday, this Saturday. So people have a lot of concerns. There are a lot of engaged people all across our country who want to express their views on things like Betsy DeVos for Education Secretary, someone who doesn't even believe in public schools, Tom Price for Human Services, who wants to basically undo Medicare and privatize Social Security. So there are a lot of concerns that I know my constituents have and the people of Hawaii have, and this is time for them to come and talk story with me at these town halls this Saturday.
Thank you so much for
Thank
the attendance
you.
Today.
Take care.
Mazie Hirono is a junior U.S. Senator for the state of Hawaii. Details about the two town hall meetings are on our Facebook page, The Conversation-Hawaii Public Radio.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, amorous hijinks in an enchanted forest. But first, your quiz.
Unihoa, umulokai, ulanahi, umau, ukahoolave, uhawaiti.
Since we just heard from one of Hawaii's two current U.S. senators, we decided to make one of Hawaii's past senators the subject of today's backyard quiz. Senator Hiram Fong has been the subject of previous quizzes, specifically the quirky nature in which he was designated as the senior senator from Hawaii. The senior senator from any state is the office holder who has been continuously serving in the Senate longer. When Hawaii achieved statehood in 1959, it elected two new U.S. senators, and seniority was determined via a coin toss. Senator Fong won that toss and the title of senior senator. But for today's quiz, we'd like to know if you know who was the junior senator who lost that coin toss. You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And if you're first and right, you get the prize.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Inter Island Solar Supply, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
It's all too easy to look at our lives, especially if we're talking about the lives of lovers, as the playthings of unseen forces. In Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, those forces are the fairies, and mortals, fools that they are prey to their caprices. Director Eden Lee Murray has put the fairies at the forefront of her HPU Young Actors Ensemble production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, and she's with us in our studio. Hi, Eden Lee. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much.
Shakespeare spends a lot of time in various plays sort of speculating about why we do the things we do and who's pulling the strings, yeah?
Yeah. Well, and what we've sort of done with this production is to turn that on its ear, which mm-hmm. is to say, rather than tell the story conventionally, we've given a take where the fairies themselves are the ones who, by the way, fairies have a very low regard for human beings. We're clumsy, we're awkward, we're kind of slow.
They make that clear.
Yeah, and they operate on a much, much quicker frequency. Because I have a smaller company this year, having moved it from the Hawaii Theater, where I was for 7 years, up to HPU, mm-hmm. And by the way, hosted most generously by Rayanne Montague and the College of Extended and Interdisciplinary Education, they hosted the group that I brought with me. Mm-hmm. And we have a smaller group because some of the kids couldn't make it over the mountain, right? But now we've got 15, and what I did with Macbeth in 2012 when I had as small a company was to create a coven of witches that then each played one or two or three roles mm-hmm. of the mortals in Macbeth. Well, in this case, the fairies, first of all, have to understand what fairies are, and then each fairy has specifically selected one, two, or three mortals to lambaste mm-hmm. and to make fun of. So the fairies, it's really fun for the kids because they not only have to play the fairies speaking fairy-ish, which we got from Tony Pisculi's invented language midsummer last year at Hawaii Shakespeare Festival, and he mm-hmm. most generously let us borrow words, phrases, etc., to create that language mm-hmm. for what the fairies bring into the theater at the beginning. And then during the course of telling the story, and there's some magic at the beginning that lets the audience suddenly understand what the fairies are saying, and that magic is undone at the end of the play as the fairies leave. But somewhere during the course of the play, as these kids play the fairies, playing the mortals full on, as foolish as the fairies seem to think they are, mm-hmm. there's a point where Lord, what fools these mortals be, transforms into empathizing with the mortals whose stories mm-hmm. they are bringing to life. So much so that by the end, when Oberon blesses the house of Theseus and Hippolyta and the other couples that get married, and Puck comes forward with an all-out apology to the audience. If we spirits have offended, or if we shadows have offended, think but this, and all is mended. And they leave blessing the space, blessing the mortals who have watched them play, mm-hmm. and taking their language back. So it's an interesting arc.
That's kind of an apologia that happens at various places in Shakespeare, right? In the prologue to Henry V, you know, you say to the audience, you talk directly to the audience, bear with us.
Yeah, forgive us for not being really there, but if you just imagine it, we've got this becomes that.
Plains
exactly,
and,
right. Well, the thing that I'm excited about, especially with this group of kids, with this production, is it's my contention that the theater skills, performance skills, are really thinly veiled life skills.
Mm-hmm.
And what people, but especially young players, learn during the course of learning theater, they have to stand in someone else's shoes. They have to. And once you've done that, you can't judge them. So what our kids are learning as they play, it's the box in a box. The fairies learn their lesson about mortals, mm-hmm. as I hope the children that I train learn about as they learn how to understand how other people feel and bring those feelings to life.
That adds a layer onto a standard summertime warhorse of young lovers parted and reunited at the end, happily ever after, Midsummer Night's Dream, the standard take, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And what's really fun to me, because one of the traps, and I'm warning my kids about this, one of the traps for playing comedy is that you think you're funny.
Oh, yeah.
Or you try to be funny. And
you telegraph it.
When the fairies are trying to show the audience how stupid these mortals are, what they have to do is to play, take what the mortals take seriously, so seriously that then the fairies can laugh at it. But that means that the audience sees these mortals pulling for what they want full tilt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what's going to be really tricky is fun, too, because this weekend at the Book and Music Festival, I'm bringing in the Pyramus and Thisbe play within a play in Act 5. Usually in the past 7 years, I've done the full play at Hawaii Theater and then done a sort of a Monty Python-esque abbreviation,
mm-hmm.
definitely less than serious, for the kids to then bring into Book and Music for making it clear that they know what they're doing with the language but not belaboring the audience with full-on Shakespeare at a festival, right?
Mm-hmm.
This year, because our play is coming up next weekend, I didn't do a parody for them, but Shakespeare very kindly let us off the hook by providing what is essentially a piece of delicious ineptitude as these rude mechanicals step forward and do the best they can, but it's the epitome of bad acting. Right?
And you know it had them rolling in the aisles if they had aisles at the Globe Theater.
I think so. And we're going to put that up. We're going to close the Keiki stage on Sunday at 4:30 with that. And again, I've told the kids they can't think they're funny, but I'm telling you, as I watch them rehearse for this Sunday, I'm in tears. I'm laughing so hard.
Well, thinking you're funny is disastrous
if
you're performing comedy.
Yeah.
You know, and that's that's where self-consciousness, in all acting can ruin it. Wanting to be liked, wanting to be disliked, wanting to,
absolutely
worrying about who you are.
Right. Well, what's fun, the guide I've given the kids who are doing the Rude Mechanicals this weekend is it's like clown diving. I was a diver for a long time, and I could never do clown diving because you have to be so good at what you do that you can then do it badly.
Right.
So what I'm telling my kids is don't worry about what your audience is going to think of you, because you guys need to be good enough to take these buffoons so seriously that they are funny without trying to be funny.
Well, we see evidence of that all the time. Buffoons never think they're buffoons. But that's another interview for another time.
Yes.
Thanks so much for coming
Thank you so much, Chris.
Sure. Eden Lee Murray is the director of the HPU Young Actors Ensemble production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, which will be performed the weekend of May 12th at the Paul and Vi Lou Theater on HPU's Windward campus.
Two candidates are vying for the position of school superintendent, and one of them may have it come next week. CivilBeat.org reporter Chad Blair joins us now with a reality check. Hey there.
Aloha Friday, Beth Ann.
And a good Aloha Friday to you, too. So we've got two finalists for Hawaii School Superintendent, And the question is, who really are these women? Both of them are women. And how different are they from each other?
There's some commonalities. And by the way, the resumes for both candidates, Linda Chen and Christina Kishimoto, they're on our webpage. You can go to Courtney Teague's story and read for yourself. And if you're a concerned citizen, a parent with your kids in school, you can weigh in. You can let the Board of Education know what you think, because you're right. The decision could come next week. Interestingly enough, both of them attended Columbia University's Teachers College. They both have mixed immigrant backgrounds. Chin credits her Chinese immigrant parents for making education a priority. Kishimoto, I believe, has a half Japanese girl that goes to school here in Hilo. She's actually from Puerto Rico and has her own interesting background. So a lot of commonality. They also share in common that neither of them have been in an administrative post for such a large school district. As you know, Hawaii is the only state in the country with a statewide school district, and it's enormous, 290 schools, 180,000 students. So that's a big concern for both candidates.
And the fact that neither candidate comes from Hawaii, for some right. people, has been a concern. Has it been very much based on some of the response that they received when they were giving a public talk?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We're so concerned about having local experience, and that's very important to us here. And yet, here we have two mainland candidates coming in. And it doesn't appear to have been an obstacle so far. In fact, maybe some thinking that it might be fresh to have an outsider come in with a new perspective. The last couple of BOE superintendents we've had, most of them have been local born and bred. And so that brings a new twist to this search.
All right. Well, we don't have long to wait to see. Anything else that you can think that might distinguish one versus the other?
Well, I'm going to encourage our readers. I'm going to tease them to go to our website because I don't
you
want to
give
up. You
did already.
I did already. But there's more information than I could possibly share. But I think you'll certainly come away with a definite impression on which candidate you prefer.
All right. Be able to look at maybe some of what they've said during their public remarks. Thanks a lot. We will talk to you next week.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Bethann.
Thanks, Chad. Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org, today featuring Chad Blair.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
Well, the 2017 legislative session is now over, still with an 11th-hour reorganization and no solution to rail funding. Talk about the session will continue. We asked Wayne Yoshioka, HPR's political reporter, for his take on the last days of this year's legislature. Hello there.
Hello, Bethann. I think looking back with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, the legislature really lost their way. You could see every week them getting deeper and deeper and mired in all kinds of passion and emotional arguments.
So what do you mean, though, when you say that they lost their way? In what way?
They turned a bill on taxation, which had to do with the county surcharge, and they turned it into a mandate to investigate the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation to discuss construction issues, alternative modes.
So you're talking about oversight.
Yeah, basically providing legislative oversight over a county project, which was really inappropriate. All they were being asked to do was to find a funding mechanism for rail and to say, do they need it and do they deserve it? And it was just legislation to enable the county to spend the money and not a legislative appropriation per se that gave the county this money. So it was really something that they shouldn't have gotten into and didn't have to get into for this really specific reason.
The fact that this session, as we started, already had rail overshadowing so many of the other issues. And then as we continued on, and especially in the last couple of weeks, sucked the air out of the room in so many ways. And then we had this reorganization that came down in the 11th hour. What does that say about those who were ousted and those who were brought in, and just in general, what the component parts of both chambers are now?
I think, well, from Representative McKelvey and his pesticide regulation bill, all the way through the legislation and all the different types of reappointments and resignations, I think looking forward, they need to reorganize in such a way where they have a statewide view, where they don't get mired into parochial issues, where they look at it as a state legislature. So I think going forward, they have a great challenge ahead of them, and they need to realize that Hawaii is going to have big problems, it's going to take big ideas, and it's going to take a bigger view than just the parochial county view.
And then what about the idea, though, that you have seniority versus experience at play at work, as we've seen in the reorganization?
Well, as we were told, 33% of the House members have less than 10 years of service. And so the experience level is really changing, and so is the demographics. You have more women in the House and Senate. You have a younger group. You have 12 millennials in the House themselves. So I think House Speaker Saiki has a big challenge ahead of him to organize it in such a way where they have a statewide view on statewide problems and also integrate it to take advantage of all the diversity that they have in both the House and Senate.
And with all this roiling, chances of having a special session, pretty low.
They're so far apart, I don't suspect that they will reach any type of an agreement, so especially on rail.
Wayne Yoshioka, thank you. Wayne Yoshioka is HPR's political reporter.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, Locations, Noheia Gallery, and Straub Medical Center.
There are familiar sayings about age. You're only as old as you feel. Age is just a number. To those, AARP CEO Joanne Jenkins would like to add a two-word phrase, disrupt aging. It's the title of her new book. She's in Honolulu this weekend for the Book and Music Festival, and she's in our studio today. Hello there. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
When we talk about attitudes toward aging, that's one thing, and that's going to be a long time in being able to shift. But more immediately, we have some very real concerns that are coming out of Washington. Clearly, you're based there, and you've been walking the hill and talking to a lot of the folks in Congress. As you look at it now, and given the fact that so much of what happens in Hawaii is dependent on those Medicaid dollars, what do you see for us in our future?
Well, certainly we are monitoring the situation and participating in our advocacy efforts in Washington. The House passed bill of ACHA day before yesterday really causes us great concern. We actually think it's worse than the bill that the House had Republicans had put forth just a couple weeks earlier. And it's so critical, particularly as so many Americans are growing older and living longer, that we have to have basic safeguards in place, particularly with relationship to access to health care. And obviously, Medicaid is a big part of keeping so many people out of poverty. And here in Hawaii, that's sort of accelerated because of the increased longevity of people living longer and healthier here in Hawaii, but causing great concern, not just here, but across the country about how detrimental this particular bill would be for older Americans and how the cost of health care would older Americans would be bearing the brunt of these additional changes that are being put forth in this bill. So
in Hawaii, it may not just be older Americans who are bearing those costs because we have multi-generational families. We have the greatest longevity of any of the other states. So for us, it seems to be we get hit with a double whammy, if you will, because somebody is going to have to pick up the care, plus the fact that we are geographically remote from each other, island to island, and all services are not available everywhere.
Well, that's certainly a particular emphasis and focus here in Hawaii. We know that the large number of people who will be affected by this will be older Americans. And if you listen to the rhetoric coming out of House Republicans, it is that they're trying to bring down the cost for younger people who are healthier. But the truth of the matter is it's going to cost all of us more money, and that we need to be working together, Republican, Democrat, across the aisles with all of us to try to come up with workable solutions that really puts the American people first and moves us out of the party politics, because health care and access to care is so important for all of us to live healthier lives.
As you heard U.S. Senator from Hawaii, Maisie Hirono, say a little earlier this morning, that once this gets to the Senate, it's going to be a very different situation than what we saw this week with the House. But as far as you're concerned, there's nothing about this bill that could in any way, shape, or form pass muster with you?
Well, we know that the Senate has said they will start from scratch. We also know that they have decided, the head of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, has said that they will use the budget reconciliation process, which means that they have to have the CBO score before they start taking actions. And so we will be looking to the Senate and trying to work with them to make sure that the issues of pre-existing conditions are put forth that was in the ACA, and bringing down the cost of prescription drugs, as well as having access to have your younger kids on your health insurance plan. They're up to age 26. All of these things are so important. Why AARP was so supportive of the ACA when it started. But we know that the Senate operates in a different manner than the House, and so they will be running through also the Byrd Amendment, which makes it which means that they will have to go through a separate process in order to reach a bill to the floor. The Byrd Amendment calls for those things that are only related to the budgeting process can go through in order to have a 51-49 vote in order for a bill to pass. And so we see it as a very different approach than what the House has taken. And already they've announced that they have a working group that's starting from scratch to build out a budget on this.
Beyond health care, direct health care, there's also the issue of caregiving. And that is becoming a greater and greater issue for every one of us, because as we've been told over and over again, chances are that we are either going to be a caregiver or we're going to need a caregiver. Either way, you're talking about understanding what that means and certain other accommodations for all of that. As you go and talk to congressmen and women, do they understand what's happening with Americans, older Americans, and their families when it comes to caregiving?
Well, I would say that the good thing is that whether you're talking to Senate or House members, Democrat or Republican, they all have their own caregiving story of either taking care of a spouse or a loved one or a parent. And we've been able over the last couple of years to raise the visibility of the need for us as a country to think about the future of caregiving and caregivers, the information and access to resources that caregivers are going to need. But it is true that, as you said, you're either going to be a caregiver or need a caregiver. And our latest estimates is that a family non-paid caregiver provides services that would amount to over $450 billion annually if, in fact, those family members were being paid. And so we are certainly trying to work not only at the national level but at the state level to really try to work with the legislatures to give some kind of relief for caregivers. And Hawaii seems to be leading the way in this effort of really at least taking the first steps to look at how some kind of financial assistance and relief could be provided to caregivers
the just passed, so there would be a $70 per day stipend if that money, in fact, can be found to be able to give to families so that people can stay working and maybe have somebody else take grandmom to the doctor or take grandpa to something else or whatever it may be, and you don't have to have so much of a bite taken out of a working life. as we look at this in the fullness of this, we need to remember that we have, what, about 154,000 caregivers in Hawaii. This affects a lot of people, and it will continue to affect more as we all continue to age. Is there a next step that you think has to happen at a federal level that would be able to take this further than what maybe states may be able to do on their own, despite the fact that, you know, we are living in the era, at least in our state, of blue state federalism, and looking at how we're going to move forward? What do you think has to happen if they, in fact, appreciate caregiving?
Well, we're certainly trying to work in a bipartisan way to get and have received a number of support from members on both sides of the aisle to really raise this issue about the needs of caregivers, to try to come up with a national strategy for the country on how to address this issue. And as you said, this longevity, the fastest growing age group in the country is people over the age of 85, and the second is over the age of 100. And so how do we address this idea that we're going to have 4 and 5 generations of families living at the same time in the communities, and how do we provide the appropriate level of support for caregivers? The idea that we're asking family members to provide medical services and support that traditionally would be required by a registered nurse.
Beyond just what may happen at home and with caregiving, you're also talking about having now several generations, 3, 4 generations in a workplace. And to hear a lot of older Americans tell it, older being defined anything as, you know, like 50 and up, which seems in this day and age to be kind of ridiculous to talk about that as older. But still, this sense that it's very different when you're out looking for a job and you're 60. And you may wind up with a boss who's 35, who may have not a lot of real experience, or maybe even a 25-year-old boss who may not have a lot of experience in management. What do you do to disrupt aging in the workplace?
Well, we're actually doing a lot in this area, and many workplaces, including AARP, has 3 and 4 generations working today. And we're also finding that this idea of trying to pit generations against each other really is not something that's going to help either the business or the person who's winning that particular battle. And we're seeing that pairing that younger generation who's probably more technology savvy with that older worker who probably has more business experience and business acumen reliability in the workplace is actually turning out better business outcomes and better solutions in the business community. And we have a report coming out shortly that talks to how important it is to have multiple generations in the workplace at one time. And so the future of work, particularly in areas like Hawaii that has such a shortage of workers, I think you guys have the lowest unemployment rate of any of the states. The idea of this shortage of healthcare workers, of educational resources, this is an opportunity for us as a country to continue to employ older workers as well as younger workers and not pitting them against each other.
We have to leave you in just about a minute, but if there's one thing about disrupting aging that you think we need to firmly take with us and to ruminate about a little bit that we haven't yet heard, what is it?
It's about how do we start changing the conversation about age and how do we value people for who they are, not how old they are. And you said it earlier. I often say, what if we move middle age to 65? Because many of us, I know out of our 38 million members, a large part of them are telling us that they want to continue working well into their 60s and 70s and beyond. And we know that people who have purpose and meaning in their lives and a place to go and things to do live on average 6 to 7 years longer. So,
and they're healthier.
And they're healthier.
All right. Thank you so much. We'll look forward to hearing more from you at the Hawaii Book and Music Festival tomorrow.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. Joanne Jenkins is the CEO of AARP. It represents over 37 million Americans and primarily focuses on issues related to aging. She'll be speaking tomorrow at the Book of Music Festival. And if you want to have details about that, just check our Facebook page, The Conversation Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we were thinking of a past U.S. senator from Hawaii who was designated the junior senator at the time of his election. The seniority was determined by a coin toss in 1959 after the newly formed state of Hawaii had elected its first full delegation to U.S. Congress. The man Hiram Fong beat in that coin toss was a former territorial governor and came to Hawaii in 1917 by way of Altoona, Kansas, to work as a social worker in Hilo. After being appointed territorial governor by Harry Truman in 1953, he served in the territorial Senate until being elected to the U.S. Senate in 1959 with Hiram Fong. His name was Orrin Long.
And Stanton Lum called us from Makiki, knew the answer, and will be receiving the prize, so good on you. That's today's quiz, and if you have one for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, a literacy program used by Hawaii students in grades 2 through 12, offering home edition with parent support in 19 languages. Achieve3000.com.
Allison Adams Tucker is a jazz artist on the move who has made her travels the focus of her musical journey, singing in six languages and extending the repertoire with songs from composers around the world. She's performing songs from her latest recording, Wanderlust, in our Atherton studio next weekend. She's on the phone with us from the West Coast. Hi, Allison.
Hi, aloha.
It's a kind of timely for you to be doing this album because that kind of describes the career you've made for yourself, doesn't it?
It seemed a real natural fit when producer Matt Pearson came up with the concept.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, definitely. And it's something that I've kind of touched on in previous albums, but having the crux of the wanderlust travel bug be the theme for this album was a lot of fun because it's really where my passion lies.
It really reflects the way jazz has traveled over the last couple of generations to become the international art form that it now is, yeah?
I was just thinking about that. This morning I got a video link for the International Jazz Day celebration in Havana, Cuba, mm-hmm. which happened on the 30th, just a few days ago, and got to watch the show and was reminded of how international this American art form has become. And there really are no defining boundaries anymore.
Well, that's a very welcome change because, you know, jazz was due to have a new infusion into the repertoire, don't you think?
I think it's part of the definition of jazz. I mean, having freedom to interpret anything, any genre of music in an improvisational way,
mm-hmm.
it requires infusion of cultures and infusion of regions and maybe even, you know, sub-regions, small regions, even if they were down in good old New Orleans, you know, the neighborhoods. We're going to have infusion of all kinds of flavors of cultures.
Well, it's like a shark. It has to keep swimming or it dies, right?
Oh, wow. Interesting.
I don't know why popped into my head, but you know what I mean. That if jazz isn't moving forward, then it's kind of something else.
It's dead.
Hey,
it's
I wanted
pop.
To.
Yeah. Well, I shouldn't say that. Not that pop is dead, but.
But you know, jazz. Let's just say it can never be allowed to stagnate, right?
Absolutely.
You know, I want to play a couple of quick samples from this Wanderlust record, and the first one is you're singing in Japanese.
Yes, and probably the language that is most comfortable to me. I spent the most time living in that country, and I have a very dear place in my heart for it.
Let's hear a taste of that.
Great.
Now, that takes a good deal of familiarity with the language to be able to render properly, doesn't it?
That song is actually a song of the region that I lived in, and I'm especially dear. I kind of incorporated a little bit of the way that we spoke in my town of Maizuru in Kyoto Prefecture. And that song is Takeda no Komori Uta, Takeda Lullaby. Mm-hmm. And Takeda is in Kyoto Prefecture, just, gosh, a few train stops away from where I lived. And I wanted to have the flavor of the way that I speak to my friends in that small region, which is different than the way that you would speak to someone in the city of Kyoto or Osaka or even much more differently in Tokyo.
It takes a close understanding of you're talking about a regional dialect now. We've also got a quick sample of you singing in Portuguese.
Águas de Março, yeah, one of my favorites by the great Antonio Carlos Jobim.
É pedra, é o fim do caminho. É o resto de topo, é palco sozinho. É caco de vidro, é vida, eu sou. É a noite, morte, é o laço, o anzol. É peraba do campo, é no da madeira.
Alison, you mentioned Jobim, and just that one composer alone has done so much for jazz, hasn't he?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'd say he and Vinicius G. Moraes and all of his brothers, his musical brothers, that started that bossa nova movement back in the late 50s were the beginning of fusing jazz with Brazilian music.
Yeah. Well, and there's just a lot of life there, you know. Just the way those songs are constructed is offers a different set of challenges, doesn't it?
It does. And the complexity of the chord changes and intervals. And then you throw in the Brazilian rhythms, of which there are hundreds.
Yeah.
And they are born into these people almost genetically, something that I really continue to have to work a lot on to understand from a musical way.
Well, in both those examples, Alison, you have the thing where the musical feel is very much a part of a local culture, and you can't be superficial about it, can you?
I guess some people can, and there are people that would enjoy listening to that, and people who would enjoy giving it that way. However, it's not the way that I.
You're not one of them.
To sound.
Yeah.
It's got to be on a personal and authentic level.
Which takes quite a bit of study, and that's, of course, informed by your travels as well, I would think.
Most definitely informed by my travels, and then just the digital age that we live in now. There are so many opportunities to educate yourself at home, just on the internet, listening to countless live versions of various people, from pro down to amateur, down to, you know, just hobbyist, performing their native tongue, for example, in a song that they enjoy, and just kind of getting the differences in phrasing and pronunciation and emotion in songs is one of the things that I do when I'm learning a new song, and if it's not in my language.
Well, Alison, we'll look forward to hearing you. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much. Great to talk to you again, Chris.
You bet. Alison Adams-Tucker will open the 2017 Atherton summer season on Friday, May 12th, with Wanderlust, described as a travel memoir and song. You can get details on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
In Spain, for reasons I don't explain, I remain enjoying a brew. Don't deplore my fondness for Fundador. You know how a Fundador.
With the weekend approaching, it's time to look at activities going on around the state with Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama. Events going on under the radar. And what have we got today, Derek?
Well, speaking of music, there's a free performance featuring our next generation's concert artists. The Punahou Chamber Music Program presents a spring chamber music recital, and students, string quartets and a piano quintet will perform works by Haydn, Beethoven, Schubert, Ravel, and more. It's happening in Dillingham Hall at Punahou School tomorrow from 4 to 5:30 p.m., and it's free.
And here's I guess you'd call it a public service opportunity on Hawaii Island.
That's right. Folks on the Big Island can help take care of a UNESCO World Heritage site tomorrow. It's called Stewardship at the Summit. And it's at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. Volunteers are needed to help remove invasive non-native plant species that prevent native plants from growing in the park. Wear sturdy hiking shoes and long pants. Gloves and tools are provided. No advance registration is required. Just meet at Kilauea Visitor Center a little before 9 a.m.
Wear a hat, maybe a little sunscreen.
Yes, huh? Yes, please.
And it's free comic book today.
Tomorrow. Free comic book day tomorrow in many Hawaii public libraries. Just show your valid state library card at 24 designated libraries statewide and receive a special free comic book while supplies last. If you don't have a card, you can apply for one. Some titles are Guardians of the Galaxy, Doctor Who, and The Legend of Zelda. Comic book selections will vary by library. And for more information, just visit librarieshawaii.org.
I think that might be very likely draw a crowd, Derek.
Oh, yes, yes.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. And you can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
And that'll do it for us for this week. Some of the conversation starting on Monday. Well, we'll be talking with Ruth Gates to talk more about coral reef research and what she thinks of the legislation introduced by Representative Colleen Hanabusa and, of course, Senator Mazie Hirono, who we talked to earlier today.
And Manoa Valley Theater tackles a classic thriller.
In the meantime, we like to hear from you. You can call the talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook at The Conversation-Hawaii Public Radio, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation or say hello to me at BKOZHPR.
The music you hear on the show can be found in our playlist on our page at hawaiipublicradio.org, where you can also listen back to today's show. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday when we pick up The Conversation.